This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll talk with Robbie Mirapol about the 60th anniversary of the Rosenberg execution.
He was 3 years old when his parents were killed. His brother was 7. They were adopted by the Mirapol family and went on to lead productive political lives. Bloomberg's New York, the Gilded City, is the title of a special issue of The Nation magazine. We'll speak today with one of the co-editors of the special issue, Lizzie Ratner.
The special issue asks, who the city is gilded for? Gilded for all or just the 1%?
Stay with us.
New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, Executive Director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, President Emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights. This is Michael Ratner. I'm here to bring you some updates around Julian Assange, Bradley Manning, Jeremy Hammond, and others who are facing the sledgehammer of the United States against dissent. On Monday, June 3rd, I was at the trial of Bradley Manning. I heard the opening statements. I'd been there earlier on Sunday where I was on a panel with Daniel Ellsberg, Jesslyn Raddick, a number of other whistleblowers. Quite incredible.
Michael, over the past couple of months, you've served as media analyst in many ways. And in the last couple of weeks, there have been several writings on Assange, Bradley Manning, by Julian Assange. What's happening with the press?
Well, it is press, but of course, as listeners probably know are aware of, that the Center for Constitutional Rights and I represent Julian Assange and WikiLeaks. And in that capacity, of course, I go to the Bradley Manning trial. I went to the day that Jeremy Hammond, the Stratfor hacker, pleaded guilty. So I've been quite deeply involved in these cases. I was at Bradley Manning's trial on June 3rd, which was the opening day of the trial, and I do want to talk about that a bit. Before doing so, I want to bring our readers' attention to a number of important writings that have come out in the last week. We'll have them linked on our website. The first, which is quite moving, is Julian Assange wrote a statement on the first day of the Manning trial. Julian Assange has been quite supportive of Bradley Manning, and that statement is on the WikiLeaks.org website. I'll just read one paragraph from it, or actually Heidi will read one paragraph from it. I'm going to hand it to her now. Heidi?
We no longer need to comprehend the, quote, Kafkaesque through the lens of fiction or allegory. It has left the pages and lives among us, stalking our best and brightest. It is fair to call what happened to Bradley Manning a show trial. Those invested in what is called the U.S. military justice system feel obliged to defend what is going on, but the rest of us are free to describe this travesty for what it is. No serious commentator has any confidence in a benign outcome. The pretrial hearings have comprehensively eliminated any meaningful uncertainty, inflicting preemptive bans on every defense argument that had any chance of success.
You can read the full statement at WikiLeaks.org, and our website, lawanddisorder.org, will link to it as well.
Michael, you gave your scathing review of the recent film, We Steal Secrets, and Chris Hedges also wrote something. I'm just going to read a couple of lines from it. Manning is portrayed as a pitiful, naive, and sexually confused young man. Assange, who created the WikiLeaks site so whistleblowers could post information without fear of being traced, is presented as a paranoid, vindictive megalomaniac and a sexual deviant. We Steal Secrets is agitprop for the security and surveillance state.
That's from an article by Chris Hedges. You can get it on Truthdig. We'll also link to it on our website.
I saw the New York Times ran an op-ed piece by Julian Assange called The Banality of Don't Be Evil.
It's actually a response to a book called The New Digital Age by Eric Schmidt and Jared Cohn. Eric Schmidt is the executive chairman of Google, and Mr. Cohn, Jared Cohn, is a former advisor to Condoleezza Rice and Hillary Clinton, and is now the director of Google Ideas. I strongly recommend people reading this review. I'll just tell you how it ends. What the authors say, quoting from their book, what Lockheed Martin was to the 20th century, they tell us, technology and cybersecurity companies will be to the 21st. And then Julian, in critiquing it, says, without even understanding how, they have updated and seamlessly implemented George Orwell's prophecy. And then he goes on a bit about Google Glasses, and then it ends with this line. Julian calls the book essential reading. He says it's essential reading for anyone caught up in the struggle for the future, in view of one simple imperative, know your enemy. That's Julian Assange's review of The New Digital Age. Again, we'll link to it, The Banality of Don't Be Evil.
Michael, bringing us out of the digital world and back into the real world, you were at the Bradley Manning trial, which started last week. How was that first day?
You know, in a sense, Heidi and Michael, who is now here, it was like a sledgehammer. It was horribly depressing in that courtroom. It's a very small courtroom at Fort Meade. There were only 16 spectators allowed in the courtroom. I was there along with, actually, interestingly, Chris Hedges came and Cornel West came. Medea Benjamin came. A number of, you know, people who are real activists on this issue. There was a big overflow room, so people got to watch it on video, but there were only the 16 of us in the courtroom. And the first thing you go in there, and there's Bradley Manning sitting in a very small courtroom between two very large people, his lawyers. He's very small. He's 5'2 or 5'3. You know, he's already pleaded guilty to 20 years in prison that he can get. And yet the government, in their cruelness, is going to try and get him a life sentence, or at least convicted of crimes that carry a life sentence, that actually carry a death penalty, although they have said they won't do that. And that's an aiding the enemy charge, as well as a number of espionage charges. The situation was there were only 16 of us in the room, but there were hundreds of protesters there. There were 2,000 on Saturday in a protest. On Sunday, I spoke with a panel where I was the only non-whistleblower on the panel. It was interesting. Jesslyn Raddick, Daniel Ellsberg, Peter Van Buren, who was in Iraq, Thomas Drake, and others. And I didn't say to the panel, but it's not that I didn't have the courage to do whistleblowing. I was the only one who actually had never worked for the government. But that's another story. The people were, I came out a child of the 60s, so that was not exactly an option to work for the government. But these were people who in some way may have gone in with some idea that they could do some good in the government and then got totally, you know, smashed and then became smashed as whistleblowers. So that was the panel. But back to the courtroom. So the courtroom is on June 3rd, Monday, is the opening. And it really begins by the prosecution opening with a series of slides showing what they want to prove against Bradley Manning. And they go through all the computers they took the chips out of and hard drives. And the first thing you realize is anything you do, which is Julian Assange's point, there's no privacy left. They have everything. They have every time he searched for WikiLeaks over the last years, 100 times. They have it logged. They know the time. They know the date. They know everything you do on your computer. Even if you wipe it, you have to be so successful at wiping it. And then any CD you have is timestamped and marked. I mean, the whole thing is, it was a good lesson. And in that sense, I'm sorry I can't just stay there because I learned a huge amount about what they do with computers. But the bad part of this is their main charge against Bradley Manning is this aiding the enemy charge. And that's the one that a lot of people have talked about. But that's the one we ought to be terrified about. Because that's saying if any soldier leaks material to a publication, whether it's the Washington Post or WikiLeaks, and Al-Qaeda reads that, or our, quote, enemy reads that, that soldier can be charged with aiding the enemy, which is the death penalty charge. Anything. Any help you give to the enemy, under the theory of the prosecutor. I'm not saying this will be held up. I don't believe it, although the judge has gone some distance toward, I think, broadening the statute. Some people say it was narrowing, but not really. She said you have to know that it knowingly give it to the publisher and knowing that the enemy will read it. Well, anything you give to the New York Times is going to be read by the enemy. I mean, particularly if it includes Iraq or Afghanistan or anything. So it's not a very high standard to get you convicted.
And Michael, let me just ask, is this the same standard, the same law that is being brought against the Fox reporter who they're saying aided or conspired with the source?
If we look at the situation, we have the soldier, we have the indirect means of aiding the enemy, which is the publisher, it could be WikiLeaks, it could be the New York Times, and then we have, quote, the enemy, in this case, Osama bin Laden. What they're doing, first of all, is they're going after the leaker, and they're saying, if you give material to a journalist, we will treat you as giving it to the enemy because the enemy is going to read material that's published in these websites. my claim is that you need the intent to aid the enemy. You can't simply, when you're doing something for the purpose of educating the American people about war crimes, you can't simply say, well, also Al-Qaeda is going to read about war crimes. And a very good example of this is, I don't know if people probably remember that Rumsfeld was giving a press conference, the Secretary of Defense, a number of years ago, and a soldier raised his hand and said, hey, you know, we have bad body armor, we have terrible our vehicles are rusty, they're bad. And Rumsfeld makes that famous statement, we fight with the army we have, not the one we would fantasy about or whatever. Well, that technically, they could have argued is aiding the enemy, because then Al-Qaeda is going to read that, or the Taliban, or wherever, Iraq, or wherever.
They'll know our weaknesses.
Right, they'll know our weaknesses. So that's how bad this charge is against Bradley Manning. Now, the second part, when you're talking about Fox journalists, is why they're doing a 1-2 punch. First, they're getting the whistleblowers, and then they're getting the journalists. The Fox News issue is a man named James Rosen, who's a reporter for Fox. He has a source, I think it's somewhere in the State Department or NSA, and it's about something happening in Korea. And the U.S. doesn't like the source. So the FBI gets an affidavit, submits an affidavit so they can get a warrant, or at least a national security letter, to go through all his phone logs. In that warrant, what they say is, we think this journalist, James Rosen, is aiding and abetting or co-conspirator with his source. And that is incredible. I mean, that's saying that any journalist who contacts a source will be considered an aider and abettor or a co-conspirator. And Fox, of course, and people are very, very upset by that. But the problem is that when Julian Assange was accused of soliciting things for his website, for the website WikiLeaks, the U.S. had claimed that he was soliciting and was an aider and abettor and a co-conspirator. And at that point, Fox is saying he should be 6 foot underground and droned to death. So it's another illustration of, you know, what's unfortunately a true quote, but has become trite, of the Niemöller quote, first they came for the Jews, then the communists, and then they come for us. So this is the whole point is, where was Fox when they were going after Julian Assange? Where is Fox today? But what this does is make any journalist terrified of this.
It has the chilling effect on free speech. It's right. Going to discourage people from doing the kind of investigative reporting that was pretty much dead anyway, but that there were some remnants of.
So you've had the aiding the enemy, you have the looking at co-conspirators, the journalists, and then, of course, you have sources. If you're a source and you think you're going to ever talk to a journalist on the phone or anything, you know that everything you're going to do is going to be subpoenaed by the government, everything. You know, in fact, Fox, they checked when he ever went into an agency. They had his card and everything. This is really an assault on dissent.
What about the aiding the enemy charge when Bradley Manning released that video of American troops in a helicopter murdering 12 Iraqis? The Iraqis, the enemy, they already know they've been murdered. How do you rationalize that?
I don't think they can. In fact, you could actually make the opposite argument. The government and Obama have said that these kind of atrocities and things actually increase terrorism. They increase anger at the United States. So in fact, you could argue that by revealing this material and exposing it and maybe trying to stop criminality, it will actually save lives. And I just want to end this segment, because this is just an update, on what this is really about. We've talked about aiding the enemy. We've talked about all this. But in fact, when journalists ask me or others about this, I say, look, how come you're only worried about what Bradley Manning and whether he has, quote, blood on his hands, which he doesn't. No one was killed from this. He had an oath and all this. How come no one's asking for accountability for the U.S. officials who created and who were involved in all this criminality? No one is focusing on that. There's not any media saying, why don't we investigate the massacres in Afghanistan at the Farah massacre, the Guarani video? Why don't we investigate the Apache video, which is collateral murder? Why don't we investigate the U.S. officials for torture in Iraq? Nothing. They're only focused on Bradley Manning, who actually was a whistleblower and successfully brought to light the criminality of the United States. That's when we'll have justice.
The only person to go to prison on the torture issue is the CIA agent who blew the whistle that they were torturing people. He's doing 30 months.
Yeah, he blew the whistle on one of the waterboarder CIA people, and that's the only person. So we have a completely unfair system. Yes, we focus on what's happening to Bradley actually in the trial, but we also have to focus on the broader picture of we have to try and get accountability for the officials involved in criminality.
Lynn Stewart, sick as she is still in prison. She's recently written a letter to her friends and supporters, which Heidi's going to read.
Dear friends and supporters, 1 month ago, I made a request for compassionate release, which was honored by the warden at Carswell Federal Medical Center. Today, the papers are still on a desk in Washington, D.C., even though the terminal cancer that I have contracted requires expeditious action. Although I requested immediate action by the Bureau of Prisons, I find it necessary to again ask you for immediate action. Please call Attorney General Holder, President Obama, and Director Samuels, and Prison and Department of Correction Director Charles Samuels, and request immediate action on my behalf.
Our Attorney General Eric Holder is at 202-514-2001. The White House, President Obama, is at 202-456-1414. And finally, the Director of the Bureau of Prisons, Charles Samuels, is at 202-307-3198, extension 3. Thanks for your help. June 16th marks the 60th anniversary of the execution of Julius and Ethel Rosenberg. They were framed up by the U.S. government and convicted of conspiracy to commit espionage. Today we speak with Robbie Mirapol, the younger son of Ethel and Julius. He's an author, activist, attorney, and a public speaker. Robbie founded the Rosenberg Fund for Children, which provides educational and emotional support for both targeted activist youth and children whose parents have been harassed, injured, jailed, or died because of their activism. This week, the event Carry It Forward celebrate the Children of Resistance 60th anniversary of the Rosenberg execution marks one of the most significant turning points in American political history.
Robert Mirapol, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me.
It's hard to believe, but in a week or so, we're coming up on the 60th anniversary of the Rosenberg execution. And to mark that anniversary, you're holding a special event for the Rosenberg Fund for Children. Can you talk a bit about that organization? You founded it. What does it do?
Yes. On the 60th anniversary, or close to the 60th anniversary of my parents' execution, the Rosenberg Fund for Children on Sunday evening, June 16th at Town Hall, will be holding a commemorative event. The Rosenberg Fund for Children is a public foundation that provides for the educational and emotional needs of the children of targeted activists in the United States. I founded this organization in 1990, and it started from very modest beginnings. I think the very first set of grants we gave away in 1991 were for $808. We now give away about $350,000 to $400,000 a year. We help hundreds of children of targeted progressive activists across the country. And in some ways, you could say that the Rosenberg Fund for Children was a vehicle for me to create something positive in response to the destruction that was visited upon my family when my parents were arrested and I was just 3 years old. That's what this program is all about at Town Hall. I think that listeners may get the sense that this is going to be another rally or event with a whole set of speeches, and that's not what it is. It's a dramatic performance. We're dramatizing the stories of people who are struggling against repression, both from the 1950s and from today. Political prisoners, organizers, families who are on the front line today, as well as our history, and that's it's going to be interspersed with music and poetry. Everything is scripted, everything is organized. Anybody who's ever attended any of the few programs that we've done will know what I'm talking about. It's an uplifting evening, one that's thoroughly enjoyable. For those who are interested in attending the program, for further information, go to the Rosenberg Fund for Children website.
Let me ask you about the actual frame-up and persecution of your parents, because it's so relevant to what's going on today. Back 60 years ago, the sentencing judge Kaufman said, using fear, he said about your parents, their conduct in putting into the hands of the Russians the A-bomb had already caused the communist aggression in Korea, with the resultant casualties exceeding 50,000. And who knows but that millions more innocent people may pay the price of your treason. Well, that's what they were accused of doing, framed up and executed. But tell us, they were political activists, and what did they really do? And what purpose did this frame-up serve?
They were, I mean, one of the things that's quite interesting about Judge Kaufman's sentencing statement, justifying a death sentence after a conviction for conspiracy to commit espionage by using the word treason, and saying that my parents, the real charge against my parents in the public mind was at the height of the McCarthy period, that they stole what was called the secret of the atomic bomb and gave it to the Soviet Union. In other words, they threatened the existence of our entire country by their actions. The parallel today is, of course, that there's the Bradley Manning case, which is going on right at this moment, and once again, he is being charged with conspiracy to commit espionage under the exact same law that my parents were charged under. And the question that's being asked is he a whistleblower or is he a traitor? So this kind of provision of secret information is being equated with treasonous behavior. Now, in terms of my parents' case, in more specific, we now know from the government's own files, through our work on the Freedom of Information Act over the years, that my parents had nothing to do with the secret of the atomic bomb. It is true both of my parents were political activists. They were both members of the Communist Party. And my father, during the 1940s, along with several other young people, because these people were very young at the time, some of them were started in their teens and in their 20s, provided information, technical, military, and industrial information to the Soviet Union, initially to help the Soviet Union defeat Hitler during World War II. And it was illegal activity, but it wasn't the secret of the atomic bomb. But the government wanted to make a big show trial and demonstrate that people who would take this kind of conscience-driven action posed a threat to the entire nation. What better way to do that but to charge them with giving away the information that could destroy us all? And then, of course, anyone who's familiar with the Bradley Manning case sees the echoes today. So 60 years on, this case is just as relevant as it was the day it was born.
Robbie, I would add two things. Your parents were tried in the very same building where the three of us attended the Lynn Stewart trial, where she was charged with giving material support in the form of a press release, or the Cuban Five, who were charged with the same thing your parents were charged with, conspiracy to commit espionage. We have these parallels, as you point out.
The parallels are really important. You know, I just came from the Bradley Manning trial, Robbie. You know, it was overwhelming what they're trying to do. He's pleaded guilty to 20 years already, but they are charging with a death penalty crime. They say they're not going to give him the death penalty, but aiding the enemy is a death penalty crime. He's essentially, if he's convicted of that, a traitor, and with espionage as well. And they're piling everything on. They're saying hundreds of thousands of documents found on bin Laden's computer. I mean, they're implying that he was going to bring down the whole country. And in that sense, there's incredibly striking parallels.
And that is at a time when, I mean, I think there's one significant difference between today's cases and my parents' case back then. And that is that back then, the reason the judge was so keen to talk about the atomic bomb and changing the course of history and treason was because we now know that the judge was provided back channels, secret information that the National Security Agency had gathered about my parents' activities, information that was never presented to the defense, never brought up at their trial, but was told to the judge, so the judge would know from the very beginning, before the trial started, that my parents were guilty. And this information was cooked a little bit to make it look more important. But of course, the judge didn't know that, and no one had an opportunity to cross-examine any of the people presenting the information, so that never came out. So secret information was used to convict my parents. All of this was illegal and improper in those days. The change that has occurred is that the government kind of learned the lessons of my parents' case and has now figured out ways in post-9/11 America to make all the illegal activities that they engaged in order to obtain this Big Show trial conviction in the 1950s legal today and proper today. So unfortunately, one of the main differences between the two cases is that things have actually, from a constitutional perspective, gotten worse.
Well, they also had both the FBI and the prosecutor ex parte conversations with the judge. They cooked up evidence. Mm-hmm. They told witnesses how to testify, stuff that was blatantly illegal that secured the conviction. They knew that your mother had nothing to do with any of this and used her as a lever to try to get your father to confess and name names. And they were that cynical in proceeding with the death penalty charge against your mother.
There actually is an FBI file that we've released to the public that says, you know, there's no evidence against Ethel Rosenberg, but we want to get her convicted and given a stiff sentence. They didn't even contemplate the death sentence. That was something that the judge came up with on his own in order to coerce my father into cooperating. And that brings me to my situation. I was 3 years old when my parents were arrested. My brother was seven. We went through hell in the years, the 3 years between the arrests and the executions. And I grew up with this sense that this unmet need to do something about this. It wasn't until I was 43 years old in 1990 that I figured out what to do. And that was to start a foundation in my parents' name that would help children in similar circumstances, and young people too, in similar circumstances today. And that's what the Rosenberg Fund for Children is all about. We find families, grand jury resistors, Wall Street occupiers, political prisoners, military resistors, you name it, because we don't have poster children. We try to protect the privacy of people, so we don't necessarily blast out and to the public exactly who these people are, but you think of the movement, you think of who's targeted, and if there are people with children involved, we come to the aid of their kids by providing for their educational and emotional needs. We can't solve the problem. That we can't take on the powers that be. We can't release Leonard Peltier from prison, but we can bring his great-grandchildren and grandchildren to visit him so that he gets some joy. You know, we can't release Lynn Stewart from prison, though hopefully she will be released soon, but we can fund visits from her family. So we can do these kind of helpful things, and we want to dramatize and tell those stories on June 16th. And that's the legacy of the Rosenberg case. For me, this program is also particularly important because I've been running this. I started this foundation a long time ago. I'm now in my upper 60s. It is time to move on, to involve the younger generation. My daughter has been working with me and is going to take over the directorship in the fall. And so this is kind of my farewell event. So it is personally important to me, but I think it's politically very important for us to understand how to help and protect our movement, which is absolutely critical to building it.
Robbie, you lead me to a question without talking about specific individuals. Have you seen a trend among the families that you have helped in terms of children either taking an activist route in response to what has happened to their parents, or is there stigma attached? What sort of patterns, if any, do you see?
Well, we actually host gatherings of the children and young people every few years to bring them together, to break down their isolation, to show them that they're not alone, to build networks and to strengthen their social situation. And what we find is it's all over the place. There is no distinct trend. What you will find children who are doing everything they can to follow in their parents' footsteps. And you will find children who are saying, I don't want to have anything to do with that. And you will find a range of kids in between. And our perspective is we want to help the kids. And if we can build a positive connection between what happened to their parents and the lives the children are leading, even in very difficult times, we will increase the likelihood that they will have a positive perspective on their parents' activism, and they'll carry that forward to a good place. But we're not going to impose a set of shoulds on them. I think one of the reasons that my brother and I both grew up to follow careers and activism and engage in various progressive work is because we were given the opportunity to make those choices on our own rather than having something crammed down our throats. And that's what we try to do.
Let's remind people of the website for the Rosenberg Fund for Children so they can connect and try to get over to the June 16th town hall meeting.
Yeah, I certainly hope that people listening will come and participate. I'd love to see your people, DAI listeners, there at my last major public event. And to find out more about this, the best thing to do is to go to the Rosenberg Fund for Children's website. And that's www.rfc.org. And then just follow the links to the Carry It Forward program, and you'll find it. I mean, we're lucky. We have a very simple website address, easy to find.
Robbie, are you going to be videoing it for people who aren't
in
New York and can't get there?
Yes, it is going to be videotaped. But, you know, again, one of the things that happens when things are videoed like this is that you never know what's going to come out in the end. And we will do the best we can. But the best way for people to really get the full impact of this is to come Sunday evening, the 16th. The doors open at 6:15.
We urge people to do that, Robbie. We thank you so much for being on Law & Disorder. You have our enormous respect and affection. Good luck to your daughter when she takes over the reins.
Okay, thank you.
Big
thank
hug
you
from all. All of us here at Law & Disorder, Robbie.
Bye, Robbie.
Bye-bye.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
May 6th, a special issue of The Nation appeared. It was edited by our next guest, Lizzie Ratner, and is called Bloomberg's New York, the Gilded City. The articles assess the various personas the New York mayor used to further specific agendas. Among them are the top cop, presiding over a vast surveillance program, the union buster waging war on organized labor, and the anti-democrat, undermining the city's term limits. Income inequality amongst people living in New York City has grown rapidly in the last three decades, outpacing both New York State and the nation. The article points out that there were choices available to New York City's government to counter this economic trend, yet they were basically ignored. To talk more about this special issue of the nation, we speak with one of its editors, Lizzie Ratner. Lizzie is a journalist and co-editor of the Goldstone Report, The Legacy of the Landmark Investigation of the Gaza Conflict.
Lizzie Ratner, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
And we're really excited to have you. And we're really excited to have you as one of the people involved in an incredible issue of the nation, a special New York issue called Welcome to the Gilded City of New York. I know you have a piece in there, which is wonderful, which we'll talk about, Low Wage Workers Unite. But why don't you give our listeners some sense of why this issue, what's it really saying about New York and perhaps the broader country? What are some of the key points that it brings out?
Well, we chose to focus on New York City right now because we're at a fulcrum moment in this city. It's the end of an era, the end of the Bloomberg era. Michael Bloomberg is the mayor of the city. He's been the mayor of the city for almost a dozen years now. And he is finally term limited at the end of this year, and a new mayor is going to take office. The city council, which is also responsible for running the city, is going to have a significant change, a changeover. And so we thought this is a really interesting moment to look at the city, understand what New York is today and where it could go that's different. Now, anyone who spent time in New York recently knows that it's a very different place than the iconic place of the 1970s, which was a place of New York is burning, a place of a lot of grit and creativity, but also enormous despair and poverty. When people think about New York now, they think of a very different city. They think of the glitzy city of Sex and the City or the cool, hip city of girls. And we wanted to investigate and see, well, what is New York now? And really complicate that picture. In thinking about what New York is now, we came upon a central theme, and that is inequality. Right now, a lot of people think of New York as the center of the city's culture, intellectual life, artistic life, certainly financial life, and New York is seen as this wonderful, vibrant place. And that really is a symbol of the Bloomberg era to outsiders. But peel back the cellophane a little bit, and what you see underneath is deep struggle, deep poverty, a city of profound inequality, really some of the most profound inequality in a country that is becoming more unequal by the day. So we really wanted to investigate, what is this inequality about? What does it tell us about the last 12 years of this city's life? And because New York City is kind of a metaphor at times or an emblem for the larger country, what does it tell us about the state of the larger country? And the quick answer to that is that we are a country that is becoming more unequal by the day, where you have a population of haves who have done significantly better during the last decade or two, who have become significantly richer. I might get the statistics wrong, but I think about 40 years ago or 50 years ago, the top 1% of the city owned about 12% of the city's income share. 2012, that was 39% of the city's income share. Meanwhile, the bottom half of the city possesses something like 8% of the city's wealth. So this is an enormous disequilibrium, an enormous gap, and it's obviously terrible for the people who live here and who haven't benefited from the extreme wealth pouring into the city over the last decades, but it's also bad for the health of the city.
Lizzie, there's one other number I want you to bring out that I saw early on, and I want to tell people there's an incredible interactive map when you go online at The Nation and put your cursor over different things that tells you about inequality in the city, poverty level, etc. The number I saw on that interactive map is that 1.7 million people are below the federal poverty line out of a population about 8.1, as I recall.
Yeah, that's about 21%. And there are two other disturbing facts that I'd love to pull out of that one fact. The first is that in 1980, about 21% of New York City's population lived at or below the federal poverty line. So when you think about that, in 30 years, more than 30 years, we've had effectively no progress in the realm of fighting poverty in this city. We're pretty much where we're at. Obviously, the numbers fluctuated somewhat over this time, and it improved a little bit during the 90s and stuff, but and has sort of gotten much worse since the Great Recession. But nonetheless, this really tells us that while immense wealth has poured in at the top, while you have some of the city's wealthiest zip codes seeing median income increase by 50% during the last decade, for the people at the bottom, and there's a lot of people at the bottom, things haven't changed. So that's one detail I want to pull out. The second detail I want to pull out is the fact that the federal poverty measure is sort of inadequate measure to begin with, particularly in a city like New York, which is so expensive. I've read estimates from MIT and other places that place a living wage in this city around $12 an hour for a single person, just taking care of him or herself. For people who have, say, a dependent, for two people, you know, who are paying for themselves and one another person, they have to earn about $24 an hour to earn what is effectively considered a living wage in this city. So we're dealing with a serious situation where not only are there many people who are at or below the federal poverty level, we're dealing with even more people who aren't earning a living wage. And actually, just two more harrowing statistics along that front. In 2011, about 400,000 people, or about 1 out of 10 of the city's workers, worked but did not earn enough money to actually get out of poverty. So that's the first point. The second point is that that same year, about 600,000 people earned $10 an hour or less. And again, that is considered below a living wage in this city. So we have a lot of people who are working hard and still not getting by here.
The editorial that starts off this special May 6th issue of The Nation, Bloomberg's New York, The Gilded City, the editors start off with a picture of Dumbo. Mm. That means down under the Manhattan Bridge overpass?
Yeah.
Dumbo, like the elephant,
I guess. Like the elephant, yes.
I couldn't believe it. It stuck in my mind because here you've got apartments going for $4,500 for a one-bedroom apartment. The medium income down under is $168,000 a year. Mm. And then you go on and you contrast the gilded Dumbo with the neighborhood right next door to it. And I wanted to ask you about that metaphor that you used to start off your editorial in The Nation, The Gilded City.
Yeah, I mean, I think the purpose of the editorial is to show the areas of the city which have received so much attention and so much sort of certainly media attention, but as so much sort of the love and care of the government. So a neighborhood like Dumbo, for instance, which is about 20 or 30 years ago, it was sort of a neglected industrial neighborhood, and you had squatters and artists who lived there and, in fact, named it Dumbo, in the hopes that it would sound unappealing to future gentrifiers. They clearly didn't have much luck with that. But what's happened in Dumbo is it's a beautiful neighborhood. There's a carousel. There is a lovely city park, which has, you know, ferry boats land there every day, and they take people from Manhattan, and artisanal food sort of smorgasbords that are there over the weekend, and the streets are all cobblestoned, and in fact, the cobblestones are so precious and beloved that the city has said that they will replace the cobblestones, which I guess aren't great for bikes, which a lot of people ride in the city these days, are going to replace the cobblestones with these sort of ersatz cobblestones that have been pre-aged so that they're going to look like old cobblestones, right? And the city is willing to pay for this and to encourage the development and beautification of this neighborhood. Meanwhile, a few blocks away, literally, I mean, really just 5 minutes away, you have these housing projects called the Farragut Housing Projects, which are quite distressed. This, you know, there are no cobblestones here, aged or otherwise. The streets are full of potholes. The New York City Housing Authority is, in fact, famous at this point for its neglect and mishandling of this enormously precious resource, city housing. So, you know, you go and talk to residents of Farragut houses and elevators are breaking down frequently. There's garbage piled high outside. There are all these electrical cords strewn outside the building. So the point of the metaphor was really just to contrast these two New York cities, these two enormously different worlds, the gilded world, which is flashy, which everybody sees on TV, and which is the one that's been promoted by the Bloomberg administration. As you know, New York is on the rise, New York is doing great. But yet, if you actually stop and look for 1 second, you see, again, that so many people are struggling. And not only are they just struggling, they're neglected. Their needs are neglected.
Lizzie, what's interesting to me as I travel around the country and people give me their thoughts about Bloomberg, almost everybody thinks he's a great mayor for New York. Mm-hmm. I mean, of course, he sees what upper middle class people see. They see the new bikes. They see, you know, cutting down on sodas. You know, or they see, as you say, the Guild in New York. And what they don't see is the inequality that underlies that. But one thing that's said in the editorial also is about what's called the other mayor, Bloomberg. And the editorial talks about stop and frisk, union busting, cuts in social services, and the schools. Mm-hmm. So can you just tell us a little bit about that other Bloomberg?
Yeah, I will. And I want to just, though, before I do that, echo what you said, that there is this perception of Bloomberg as a great kind of liberal icon. There is a certain disturbing truth to that, in that so much of liberalism these days is being defined as a kind of social progressivism. You know, Bloomberg is very good on gun control. He's good on gay marriage. He's great on environmental issues. He's made the city a lot more livable. All these lifestyle progressive ideals that have come for so many liberals to signify what liberalism is about.
I just want to say that's completely brilliant, Lizzie. To hear you say that is great. I mean, it's really an important point.
Yeah, and a lot of, well, thank you. And a lot of those, sort of these liberals sort of have lost track of the fundamental social values that once underlay part of American liberalism, ideas of civil rights, civil liberties, equality, worker protections, things like that. And on these issues, the Bloomberg administration has been very, very bad. You know, we have, as you said, stop and frisk, this issue that the Center for Constitutional Rights has been fighting against quite valiantly for a long time. And what it amounts to is that police go into, by and large, low-income neighborhoods, or stop, by and large, low-income populations of color, stop them, frisk them. And oftentimes the putative excuse is that this is a way to lower crime, to prevent gun violence, to get guns off the streets. But of course, what's been found actually is that there's very little correlation between stop and frisk and the actual discovery of guns, weapons, or criminal activity. And so you sort of see this incredibly disturbing, overzealous policing of these low-income disenfranchised communities. It's the same thing that we have seen also with the surveillance of Muslim communities in the city, which really tiptoes very close to the line, or frankly, I think probably tiptoes well over the line of what is constitutional. We have these sort of sacrificed populations in this city, which are being targeted, but people haven't cared. You know, the city as a whole hasn't cared that much recently because other parts of the city, life in the city, have been going nice. You know, there have been bike lanes. Similar factor, the schools, the mayor took control of the public schools, claimed control when he took office around 2001, 2002. The justification for that was that this was a way to kind of tame an unruly system, narrow the education gap between students of color and white students. If you read Diane Ravitch and Leonie Hampson's piece in the special issue, you know, they make a very strong case for the fact that all the mayor's education reform has done is really implement high-stakes testing and give it, thrown lots of bones to charter schools without actually addressing some of the key needs of students. And so really we're pretty much where we were at before in terms of the education gap between different students in the city. You know, I think one of the signature events of the Bloomberg administration was the recession, and one of his signature failures was not addressing the horrifying inequality and job loss that has happened as a result. So I'll be very specific on this subject. There have been a couple of laws that were brought to the city council that might not have revolutionized conditions for a lot of low-wage workers in this city, but would certainly have helped. And I'm thinking of the paid sick leave law, which is finally about to be passed, a living wage bill. There was an anti-predatory lending bill that was brought before the city council, and the mayor has vetoed these and stood in their way consistently. Among the mayor's other signature acts have been things like the smoking, you know, the anti-smoking law, which has banned smoking in public places. And so while the mayor says, you know what, it's absolutely fine for me to go in and say people can't smoke where they want to smoke, and I will be honest, I actually kind of do like that law,
I don't like to lie. I was sitting on a bench minding my own business, smoking a cigar, sitting in the sun, and somebody came up to me and kicked me out of the park. I was unaware of the new law.
You know, when it comes to the market, the so-called market, and regulating the market so there might actually be fairness for workers, so they might have the right to take a day if they're sick, so that they, you know, there might be a living wage for some of these workers. Bloomberg says, you can't interfere with the market.
Yeah, I think that is
really a problem.
That's important to point out. It was Christine Quinn, who may be the next mayor, who sat on that bill so that when people are sick, they don't get paid. She finally grudgingly let it out. I don't know whether it's going to pass or not. And it's the same Christine Quinn who marries her longtime lover, and Bloomberg goes to the wedding. So there's all that show about how he's tolerant about gay marriage. But on the other hand, people who get sick can't get paid for the day they miss work. What are we talking about here? But what I wanted to ask you about is the fight back, the Low Wage Workers Unite piece that you contributed. Let's talk about pushback on this. You know, the rich get rich and the poor get poorer, but the poor are also fighting back to an extent. And I wanted to talk to you about that.
Today is a nice day in that after pushing for many, many months and unionizing, the first car wash workers in the city have a signed contract with their employer, which grants them an increase in wages, which I think by 2015 go up to more than $9 with tips. You know, it's not $1 million, but it sure as hell beats the $5 they're making now. Paid sick days, vacation days, the ability to negotiate grievances with their employers, and various other things, which will make a concrete difference in workers' lives.
Lizzie, what's happened with homelessness under Bloomberg?
If you want to understand Bloomberg's failures around poverty, you just need to look at homelessness. So, quick snapshot, homelessness has, I think, almost doubled during his tenure, maybe increased about 40%. There are now more than, there are about 50,000 people a night who sleep in homeless shelters in this city. And you ask advocates, you ask people who know the issue, and they say this is really a failure of policy. The Bloomberg administration will say it's economic and behavioral, that poor people are going to shelters in record numbers simply because the shelter system is so great, and they really just want to have a chance to hang out in the wonderful New York City shelter system. In fact, you know, the real problem, advocates will say, is that it's a problem of affordability. It's a crisis of affordability. The city has not risen to the challenge of that crisis by doing things like putting homeless folks at the top of the list for Section 8 vouchers. It sounds wonky, but it's a very basic idea that would help a lot of people. Or spurring the growth of more housing that's actually affordable. Bloomberg says he's built a lot of affordable housing. Problem is, a lot of the housing, and there have been really excellent reports written on this topic, a lot of the housing is not actually affordable at the most basic levels for low-income people. And some of the housing has actually been put into neighborhoods like Brownsville, which is a very low-income neighborhood in this city. And the cost of the housing is actually more than the cost of sort of the median cost of housing in those neighborhoods. That sort of is, I guess, a bit incomprehensible. How is that affordable then? What we're seeing as a result of that is record numbers of people who simply can't afford to pay their rent. And, an important point I need to make is that there's a cliche about homeless people, and there's a cliche image of a homeless person as middle-aged man or woman living on his or her own with addiction issues, mental illness, and things like that. And while that can be the case, what has happened over the last years and decades really is that the majority of homeless people are families. Families with children who cannot pay the rent in this enormously expensive city.
We're speaking with Lizzie Ratner, who is one of the writers of the Nation issue called Welcome to the Gilded City of New York. It contains a series of articles on New York City. And we're talking to her now about her particular article in there called Low Wage Workers Unite. And it's really about the struggle and the fight back against inequality in New York, as well as going on across the country by low wage workers. And to make sure I've given everybody full disclosure, Lizzie Ratner is the niece of one of your hosts, not Michael Smith, not Heidi Boghossian, but
me, yours truly, Michael Ratner, a niece I am very proud of. If you had your druthers, if it was Mayor Lizzie Ratner instead of Mayor Michael Bloomberg,
and I'm
going to allow you to not spend $74 million on your election campaign,
and I'm
going to allow you to not give everybody that votes for you $99, which is how Bloomberg got elected. But let's say Lizzie Ratner is now the mayor. What would you do?
I mean, that's an to state the obvious, that's an enormous question. And I think you'd have to start in numerous different areas. I could list off a couple bullet points very quickly. You know, like I'd pass paid sick leave, I'd pass a living wage bill, I'd, you know, get rid of stop and frisk, I'd have an inspector general look after the NYPD. I think one of the most basic critiques of this era is that governing has happened from the top, and that Bloomberg has been sort of allergic to the needs and sort of the wishes of the people whom he represents. And there's a quote by him in that lead article, which talks about how the definition of a leader is somebody who makes a decision and then brings people along to follow that viewpoint after the fact. So I think one of the key things I would do is I would flip that and say the definition of somebody who governs this city is somebody who listens to the needs and desires and wishes and desperation of the least empowered people in the city.
Lizzie Ratner, you edited a very important special issue of the May 6th Nation magazine entitled Bloomberg's New York, the Gilded City. You can pick this up online. It's important to read it. And Lizzie, we want to thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder, and thank you for your continual good work.
Thank you both.
Big hug, Lizzie.
Big hug.
Bye.
Thank you, guys. Bye.
Bye-bye.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.